welcome back. So many of us have spent the last 6 or 7 years looking up and seeing skies that are no longer blue like they should be, seeing unusual persistent contrails, as some of the deniers like to call them. We call them chemtrails. Clifford Carnicom, of course, calls them aerosol crimes and cover-up on his website, aerosol spraying in the atmosphere. Many different levels, probably many different things going on. Clifford has done probably more than anyone will ever do in terms of a private sector investigation of chemtrails and aerosol spraying in our skies. They are very concerning. They are obviously being paid for by taxpayers' dollars. We don't know what they're doing. And it's always more than enlightening and illuminating to spend some time with Clifford Carnicom. He's back tonight for the first half of tonight's program. You'll notice his name and guests at Rents.com. Please click on his name, go to his website, and look around. If you click on his name and go to his homepage, and I always encourage people who are even remotely, honestly skeptical about this to do the reading, do the research. Go to Carnicom.com. That's C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M. Carnicom.com. Look at the pictures. Your eyes don't lie. Welcome back to the program, Clifford.
Good evening, Jeff. Thanks very much for the chance to be back with you. I appreciate it very much.
It's always a pleasure. I always learn things from you, my friend, and you share your work with the world. And those who have eyes to see, and all they have to do is look at the pictures, can figure out that something's not right with the skies up there. Out in the West, I haven't seen as much spraying in the daytime in the last year than I have in preceding years. That's my own personal observation. I don't know how it is over the rest of the country. I'm not getting as many emails with photographs as I used to. Has the aerosol spraying campaign or campaigns shifted gears to the best of your ability to understand it?
Well, I would say, Jeff, that there is... I guess two issues would come to mind. One is, on the public side, a certain level of complacency and acceptance that has taken place.
So it's working, isn't it? They're just doing it, and people are saying, well, it's nothing unusual up there.
Yeah, I think that would be one level. And then the other would be, and I have been of this opinion for some time, and that is when your concentration of this material reaches a certain level, it's also quite feasible that you would shift over to what I would call a maintenance mode, as opposed to an initiation process.
Right.
And I think it's quite possible that we are much more likely to be in a maintenance phase. The changes have taken place. The atmosphere is changed. And would be another reason that it may not be as dense if that is in fact the case. There is also some interesting seasonal variations that have been noticed, very slow because it takes a year to see each time that pattern shows up, but also during the summer months of the year, especially the later summer, July and August, there is a pattern of activity getting quieter at that point also.
Right.
But in terms of is there any diminishing of the program, I would say the program is an absolute full effect in all of its glory and disglory.
And whatever it is. And the idea of a maintenance mode now or phase is intriguing. It makes sense.
Yes, I think that's possible. And by the way, my phone is sort of acting up, so you'll have to let me know if you're having any problem.
No problem on this end. We hear you fine.
That's great. And here, on my side, it's fading in and out, but I'll just do the best I can. And so far, I'm able to hear you fine.
Okay, very good. Well, let me know,
and
we'll do our best. We'll reconnect with you at the break and see if we can pick up a better line. Now, you've got some new research you wanted to talk about tonight, so I'll let you just go ahead and lead the way, and I'll follow along as best I can.
Thanks, Jeff, very much. And I was able to provide you an outline. I hope that you received
that. I have
it.
Yes, thank you.
And if I miss something on there or there's something that needs more explanation, please let me know. It's simply a guide to give us some sense of direction tonight. And I suppose the reason that I wanted to speak to begin with is that in a somewhat unexpected way over the last 2 to 3 months, there has been a real burst of research again on my side, and I'm going to explain what motivated that tonight and what it has led to.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, we have not done a show now, probably, I would guess, for a year and a half, I would guess. Something.
That long?
I would guess it's been something like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Because 2004, which is what I'd like to start with, 2004 was a year that I devoted almost exclusively when I had the time, and that's the other part of this. It's just whenever I have the time
right.
or can make the time to do this work. It's being done at nights and weekend.
Well, you get paid so well, too.
Yes, right. And so by the end of, 2003, I believe at that point there was probably a consolidation of the research and evidence that had taken place that was sufficient to warrant shifting gears a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and I decided to direct my efforts primarily towards making a documentary on this subject. Now, I'm certainly not a filmmaker.
Excuse me, but let me thank you for the copy you sent me. It's excellent. It is prodigious in its scope and exacting in its science and specificity, and I thought it was, I don't know how you could do any better. Thank you.
I appreciate that very much, Jeff. I truly do. And, you know, with the understanding that I'm not a filmmaker by trade, and if people were really aware of the resources that were used to produce that documentary, it was a sole project entirely. I think one would have to be somewhat surprised, because it truly was a grassroots effort from the ground up with a simple video camera and a very simple computer and the resources
wow.
I have.
Wow.
And but nevertheless, because of the advantages of technology and computers and the changes, it was still possible for me to take on that project. And pretty much the entire year of 2004, it came in two phases. I had what was called a preliminary version or preview version, and it truly was that. It was not intended to be final, and I hope that you did receive the second copy.
Mm-hmm.
The first copy was meant to open the door. It was not intended to be final in any way. And that was available for about 6 months, actually longer, and closer to 8 months, I suppose. And then towards the close of 2004, I had a revision available, which I call the first edition. And that was released at the very beginning of 2004, close of 2005. And the main thing that I wanted to do at the beginning of this was to let the public know that this documentary is available. And this documentary, I think, is a little bit unique in terms of what my motivation was for making it. The motivation for making this documentary was not profit. Not profit in any way. It simply is not what drove the project. The motivation was to reach an audience and begin to extend beyond really the limitations of the internet. The internet, of course, is a very amazing medium to us, but it also has some limitations. There's no question. Basically anything goes on the net. And it's much, you reach a certain audience. In other words, it's a certain target audience and it's an important audience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the whole audience. And I wanted to try to reach a different audience than had been reached over the internet for 4 to 5 years, because we do know now that our information that we receive is essentially controlled. There's no other way you can describe it. The news available, through, if you want to call it through news, is simply a contrived affair and does not represent a journalism or research in any standing way. And so we have to do the best we can with these controls that have been placed upon the flow of information. The internet has been able to sort of weave its way amongst that control and accomplish certain things, but there's now a new generation of information types that is also becoming available, and it's largely through the power and capacity of computers available to lay folks now.
Mm-hmm.
But it is possible now for individuals such as myself to at least consider producing a documentary, where that would have been literally impossible to me only 2 or 3 years ago. So that was the reason for doing it. And also, it is different to see something as opposed to read about it. You mentioned the photographs, and I appreciate that. The photographs are very compelling in terms of a form of evidence.
Well, we are more than ever a visually oriented society now.
Absolutely. And that sort of hits it right on the nail, is that I understand that we are, and it was worth my time and effort
right.
to try to reach that eye. So that's what I did. And so this documentary is different in the sense that it was produced literally for the public to own. I mean, yes, I made it. But I actually consider this documentary to be owned by the public.
Public domain.
It absolutely is. It was turned over to the public. I took somewhat of a risk because I didn't really know whether or not I would receive any support or not, but I don't have the means to distribute this documentary in any way. And I actively called for support from the public to consider distributing this documentary on entirely a grassroots level.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three conditions for the release of this documentary. The first was that it could be freely copied in its entirety. So I welcome people, I encourage people to duplicate and copy the documentary as much as you want to or able to.
Let's hold it right there. We'll come back in just a minute and do items 2 and 3. So free copying is welcome. Clifford Carnicom is my guest. Okay, talking to Clifford Carnicom about his documentary on aerosol spraying or chemtrails, and the three conditions by which the documentary was released were: one, that it could be freely copied and spread around, and number two, Clifford?
Thank you, Jeff. The second condition for release of this documentary was that anyone that is willing to distribute it or able to distribute it cannot do so with a profit motive. No one is allowed to make money off of
it. I think that's understood. Good.
And the third is that if anyone does want to distribute it, they're entitled to compensation for, you know, any reasonable expenses for shipping and that type of thing.
Sure.
So, you know, the question was, would the public assist in this affair? And the fact is that they have, and I'm extremely grateful because it's the public that is actually making this documentary available. There's a group, I would suppose, of about a dozen people across the country now that are making this documentary available literally for just shipping costs and production costs.
Wonderful.
And that's all available on the website, and there's now about 4 countries, Spain and Australia and Canada, four countries that are distributing it also.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is reaching at least a part of the audience, and there's one individual there that has an 800 number call to get this. So I just wanted to let it be known that this documentary is available, and hopefully it will shed some light. The next topic was also fairly simple in that I just wanted to sort of bring it back home in the sense that we're literally into the seventh year of this.
Yeah, I guess 1999. Well, 99.
Close of 90, beginning of 99, okay?
That would be 7.
We're in the seventh year of this major part of the operation now that's going on. So it's pretty well entrenched. And there's a couple of photographs, and I know that not everybody listening may have access to the net. I'm hoping you might have access, and I always sort of like another person's...
I'm online watching here.
Wonderful. But on the very front page of my site, which is literally on under the name, carnicom.com, where it shows a blue screen, if you have, where the background is blue.
Yep.
There's a picture about two-thirds of the way down that of the Grand Canyon that was taken.
Looks like L.A.
And
Smog City.
This picture, this photograph, I took this photograph. We went to the Grand Canyon in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a simple fact that we are now facing. But if one goes to the Grand Canyon, which is one of the greatest natural wonders of the world, also fairly remote country in terms of a national basis. That's a little bit out there, even though there's thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people that go there.
Right.
This is, if there was any place on this earth that you thought would be relatively pristine, you might think that this would be it. I used to live in Flagstaff area back in the mid-90s, and for a period I was worked on the lookout towers.
Oh.
And I used to regularly, I was on Kendrick Peak there, and I would regularly look to the north there, because you can actually see the Grand Canyon. It's 90 miles away. You can see the Grand Canyon from Williams, Arizona.
How interesting.
If you get on the high ground.
Wow.
And you can actually, in clear weather, you can actually see anywhere from roughly 90 to 120 miles. I used to see that canyon. This photograph that I'm showing you, which, you know, you described as being like L.A., I don't think that's an exaggeration. This photograph was taken on the rim of the canyon on literally a perfect day as far as weather goes. If there was anything that you could do to make a better day, there wasn't it. That day was a perfectly blue, everything is qualified now. You know, blue in quotation marks.
Got it.
Because it's all white. Our sky is white now.
Well, it was taken on March 26th. It should be clear then.
Just March 26th of this year, there was absolutely no weather in the sky at all, no extreme winds. And this is now a typical and representative situation of what our world has become. Now, I will be as freely disclosing as I can about this photograph as I can. And the second is that this was taken in, it was definitely not taken in the direction of the sun directly. And I made a real effort to minimize any lens flare that I could get. But I did take it in the direction of sunset.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? Because that is the direction that you will now see the most visible immediate effects of placing particles in the air. And second, if you look at the folks that go to the Grand Canyon, you have two classes. One, the general public will go to the Grand Canyon, and they'll look in the direction of the sunset because they expect to see a beautiful scene at that point. And the photographers, you'll find, will actually look the other direction because of this effect is tremendously reduced if you look to the east. But I deliberately avoided any lens flares, tried to capture a true view of what I saw in the direction of a setting sun. And this is what you see. And you see a case there where you're literally talking, you know, maybe 5 to 10 miles, maybe.
I don't know what words
come to mind. The canyon is 5,000 feet deep. And across on the other side, you know, I'd have to get out the maps and measure that. But I would guess you're talking at most 10 miles, something like that, and maybe
right.
5 more realistic. And here's a case where you're looking right at the bluffs on the other side and all the intervening bluffs. And it's nothing but a washed out haze, one of the most beautiful places in the entire earth. And this is what we now have. And I don't know. I just
don't
know. At what point do you recognize that this is real, this
what
is physical?
Right. What does it take? It's pathetic. It's sad.
And this
it's
is
so
current.
Sad.
This is our current state. Yeah. And there was another photograph. We won't go through the trouble of describing it here, because the reason is it's the same effect. In the other photograph, it'll be available on a page that's called The Salts of Our Soils, which we'll talk a little bit more about tonight. But the other photograph was taken right in my territory here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we have a mountain that's roughly 12,000 feet in our area here. And I went up to the top of that mountain around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I took a photograph over the Santa Fe area. Santa Fe is not an industrial town by any means. You know, the nearest large town is Albuquerque, but the photograph that I took is of Santa Fe.
All right, we got to pause on that note. Can we look at that picture when we come back?
We sure could. If you can find it, I'd be glad to.
All right, where do I look?
The title page is The Salts of Our Soils.
All right, we'll look for it. Okay, back in just a minute with Clifford Carnicombe. All right, back with Clifford Carnicombe. We're talking about the air we breathe and live in, an ocean of air, which is becoming just as polluted, if not more polluted, than the oceans of liquid. Clifford, go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff.
I've looked for that photo. I can't find that particular link. Which category would be under?
Okay.
At the top.
Are you on the blue screen? Where
I'm on your homepage.
Yeah, on the blue screen, look for a page or a link that says... should be there. The little menu bar that says sampling and analysis.
There it is, right in the center in the
top. Yeah, and at the very bottom of that list, all the new work is at the bottom of the list.
Salts of Our Soils, there it is.
That's right.
Third from the bottom, okay.
Right. And won't spend too much time with this, but the point is there's no exaggeration here taking place whatsoever. Down about halfway through that page, you'll see a photograph of the view of Santa Fe. New Mexico, And that photograph was taken on April 19th of this year.
Looks like a major industrial city.
Yes, and this is same thing. I made a point of taking this photograph under the most ideal weather conditions that I could.
Understand. Yeah.
Those are the mountains to Albuquerque off in the distance. Actually, some of those are not even, some of those are literally just right outside the fringe of Santa Fe, and you can't see them. And, you know, it's sad to me, and it's very sobering what it is that is accepted by us. And you can view this simply as a pollution question if you want to. You know, skip your source if you want to. I don't even care if you want to skip the source. Just deal with the physical presence of pollution in our atmosphere and ask ourselves, why do we not care now? What is different that we do not care enough to keep the health of our planet?
Well, look at the dying vegetation. The planet is dying. There's no other way to look at it. It is dying, but, you know, the majority of people have TV, Clifford, and they've got remote control. And, you know, 1.1 billion in China, every household has a TV. And the mind is manipulated, managed. It's absolutely shaped from cradle to grave now in the majority of people who are swimming in the sea of mainstream media.
You know, our welfare depends upon the health of the planet. It's not the other way around.
Well, of course.
You know, but it doesn't seem like we're registering that very well.
These are very sobering pictures.
Jeff, did you say we're going to go roughly an hour and a half tonight? Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to do part two. So let's take our time. I'll try and book you either later this week or next week. We'll do the second half.
Oh, all right. So I may only get through
That's
half
fine.
The list, and we'll
what
see
we're
that
doing is basically a critical evaluation of the science that Clifford Carnicom has employed to assay the current condition of our dying atmosphere vis-a-vis aerosol spraying and other operations. So go ahead, Clifford.
Yes, and a part of what has happened on this work that's taken place over the last 2 to 3 months is that it's long overdue, but one has to develop the work as the evidence sees fit, too, also. But my work is now, you know, it's no longer to even just be talking about the atmosphere. My work has tried to begin to encompass the effects upon both the water table as well as the soil.
Well, we think of them, we are trained to compartmentalize, but it's all part of the same circle.
Yes, and that's where the work has gone. And it's, you know, the question is, how much can any one person do, whether it's me or someone else? We're dealing with literally global issues here.
Right.
The next topic that I wanted to bring up, and this is where we start to get into the heart of really what caused all of this research to take place over the last 2 to 3 months. It was unexpected. To tell you the truth, Jeff, after the documentary was done, I had made a decision that's probably about the most that I can do. I've reached pretty much the end of my resources and means to continue the work at the level that it needs to be done. I mean, we're dealing with very, very sophisticated, demanding work that needs to be done if it's going to be done properly. I'm simply trying to open the door to it.
Right.
And I had somewhat reached that conclusion. I was getting ready to take on some other endeavors. Nothing is ever forgotten, but I'm just saying I don't know how much more I could contribute. And then around April of the year, as I was getting ready to start my music lessons and such, I received a telephone call. And this telephone call was in reference to a laboratory report that had been sent to me. And I was asked whether or not I had received that report. And I said, no, I haven't received any lab reports. I'm not familiar with what you're speaking of. And so at that point, this individual made an effort to make sure that I got that report in my hand this time.
Uh-huh.
And we simply had to, it was sent through regular mail to begin with, but for whatever reason, it simply did not arrive.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm going to describe briefly what the lab report was about, and then I'm going to jump ahead to something which didn't happen till 3 months later, really at the end of my research. But I thought I would bring it up to let people know that there seems to be a much deeper system in place than we might realize to make sure that free disclosure and free discussion of this subject in any kind of open way is simply not going to take place. So I'd like to begin by describing what this lab report said and what it caused me to do. This was an individual. The individual lives in a rural portion of the country. I'll say that it's in the Minnesota-Iowa area. I've looked it up. It's not even close to being industrial at all. It's a rural location. And this individual, on his own initiative, decided to have rainwater tested for numerous elements and metals.
Okay.
Very pretty darn comprehensive test. Mm-hmm. I didn't know of this individual before in any way, but they just took it on themselves to have this test done. And so they had it done, and the report was done, and they sent me the report. Now, just at a lay level, if you look at this report, there's two things that just stick out like sore thumbs. And that is that there are what certainly would appear to be extremely high levels of calcium and potassium within this rainwater sample. Now, at some point you have to dig into the numbers, and that's what I did, because you always have to learn how much is much before you start making any kind of determinations. But just by eyeball, if you look at the report, the numbers just stick out. They're very, very large and high. So that's what I did. I looked into the absolute magnitudes of these and tried to do some research as to what was expected and asked myself whether or not these truly are unusual or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is they are. They are extremely high levels of calcium and potassium that showed up in this rainwater sample.
What do we have for an earlier benchmark?
Well, what I have done is there's a book in atmospheric chemistry comes from Cambridge University, a fellow named Hobbs.
Okay.
I had put a page up on my site from that book describing full contents of the air, and the university in England wrote to me, and they were not too kind towards me with my liberty I took to place up that page. But I've still given certainly adequate citation to that page and the other page that describes the contents
of the air. I'm sure you
do.
You always do. All right. Well,
but, so this is looks like a pretty decent source to me. These are two good books, pretty specialized
okay.
books.
All right. Stand by right there, if you would, please. We've got the stage set. We'll come back and compare what the book said and what the lab test. Again, for Private Citizen, who did his own work, which I salute always, as does Clifford. And we'll be right back. We're talking with Clifford Carnicom, so Cliff, please go right ahead and let's carry on. We have plenty of time, and I want to hear what this test was. This kind of initiative is what you did, of course, years and years ago, and it's so encouraging to see a few others doing the same thing. So tell us more.
It was very, very encouraging, and this was a lab, a regular lab that did the work. The individual just paid for it. And as we talk about this, it's going to get a little bit more involved as we go along. I'll first go by saying the amounts, and then I'll state a reaction I think many people would have. But the actual results from this, from the analysis I make, is that the calcium level is roughly on the order of five times greater than samples which were taken over Los Angeles. Now, that date was 87 in that book. I actually have two benchmarks. One is this Cambridge University book. Another is a company that actually sells rainwater. It's like simulated rainwater samples for people running tests.
Uh-huh.
So they put the concentrations of things that are expected in the rainwater in there. And they have two levels. They have one which is rather clean and one which would be considered somewhat industrial. Okay.
Right.
In both cases, it doesn't really matter which benchmark I'm using. The results are roughly equivalent. The calcium levels are on the order of five times greater than these polluted samples that would come from a highly industrial area. And the potassium is on the order of roughly 15 times.
Mm-hmm.
These are minimums. Five to 15 times greater than that was, which would occur in a polluted rain sample.
Mm-hmm.
So now you start to have some questions rise because, you know, you're talking about what is a rural part of this country, and you're talking about the presence of some minerals, you know, elements in that rainwater, which are at much higher levels than any benchmark that I can find so far about what they should be.
Huh.
Now, it gets sort of interesting because I think, I mean, my first reaction, a fairly predictable reaction is someone will say, oh, calcium and potassium in the air gee whiz, calcium and potassium are good for me.
These
minerals, you know, these are good. There's not much of a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it gets more interesting. You know, let's set aside the argument right now of the physical particulate matter. We've already actually discussed that quite a bit, but there's a direct connection between increased mortality and increased particulate matter in the air. It doesn't matter what it's made of, as long as it's solid. If you breathe more solid material, more of you are going to die. So there's a physical and mechanical side to it that you can certainly discuss. But that's not where I'm going with our discussion tonight. Let's say you let that one go aside and you're willing to have more people die by breathing more solid material. What gets more interesting, to me, is these particular elements, because I have done work now for, you know, 5-6 years that if you look through the pages, it always keeps coming back. It started from the beginning as being a hypothesis that was developed. It was eventually very slowly, I would say, confirmed through very limited test results that were available, either through myself or through others.
Mm-hmm.
And this lab test to me was a little bit of a turning point because this was solid work that was done. And it actually ties in with some work that was given to me very, very, very early in the game. I had HEPA filter given from a commercial jetliner. It was done somewhat through somewhat covert means, I suppose, is fair to say. And even at that time, there were some very unusual things happening. One of them would have been, I certainly remember the calcium. I remember calcium and magnesium because I did quite a bit of testing in rainwater early in the game. So I came up with certain salts of a particular class, and it's the class that interests me. And when this lab test comes in, it brings us right back to this focal point. And the focal point is a certain subgroup of the periodic table. And this subgroup is composed, and we won't get, you know, real technical here, but we got to get the information out. The interest is on groups 1 and group 2 of the periodic table.
All right.
Now, the question is, what is interesting and unique about group 1 and group 2 of the periodic table? And what is interesting and what is unique is that the elements in that those two groups are called the alkalis and the alkali earth metals. These elements are the elements that are most easily ionized. What is an ion? An ion is a charged particle. So these particular elements in groups 1 and group 2 of the periodic table are the elements which can most easily become electrically charged.
Ah, there we go.
Okay?
Yeah.
And this hypothesis came in from the very beginning, but when this lab report came in, it brought it right back to that home base that over and over and over, it is these particular elements that keep showing up, magnesium, calcium, barium, and potassium, now confirmed over and over and over. There are some others that would also be a suspect. Strontium, I'd have to check on that, on some hair analysis tests that came in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the process by which they would become electrically charged? What is very interesting is that the process can involve simply light, sunlight.
Hmm.
It's a really fascinating physical thing. And I had some folks that made a joke of this. They tried to discredit the work when I first put this out many, many years ago on what's called the work function of an element. But certain elements, if you subject them to the energy from sunlight alone, they will ionize. They will become electrically charged.
Hmm.
They will throw off an electron or two, and they will become positively charged. It's a fascinating thing to think that you could have literally a certain type of metal, and if sunlight hits it, that it can become create ions, charged particles.
Okay.
Now, somebody made a joke of this, and let's go ahead and get the joke out of the way, and then I'm going to let you know that this is real. It's real as can be, and go dig into it in the chemistry books, and you'll see it's a physical fact. Somebody made a joke to this fact, and they said, oh, look at Carnicum. Carnicum says if you put a teaspoon of table salt out in the sun, it'll all ionize. Okay. This is a classic attempt to ridicule,
of course,
a very serious physical phenomenon,
right,
which has enormous implications. And first of all, it's not sodium chloride that I'm talking about right now. That's not the claim. It is these four particular metals: calcium, potassium, magnesium, barium. And the fact is, it's true. go read about the salts in the air above the ocean and what it is that becomes ionized above the ocean. It will be the magnesium salts in the ocean. There are certain salts that can be ionized with sunlight alone and ultraviolet light especially. And I have a table up there that will show you, you know, you can rank this. This stuff is known. It's called the work function. You can rank these elements about how susceptible they are to being ionized by what's called photoionization, the light from sunlight. So it's a very real physical phenomenon. It has enormous implications because now you're saying the elements that are being found over and over and over are those elements that allow the production of ionized or charged particles, and that therefore led into the whole hypothesis of, you know, the whole electromagnetic thing. So what I'm saying is that now we have a lab report that sort of brings this around now to a level of confirmation that has been under investigation for many years, but now simply further establishes the reality that this is very likely what we're dealing with is this creation of an electrically altered atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll mention here at this point because it's appropriate, and that is this question of aluminum. I have seen some reports that indicate the presence of aluminum in rainfall or atmospheric dust. I've seen reports. I've never had a report in my hand. I have seen reports referenced to. I'm going to go ahead and say at this point that if anybody examines my work ever over the 7 years, you will never see me saying thus far that I have any positive test, any identification of aluminum in any of the atmospheric tests that I have done. Aluminum is not in this group at all. It does not satisfy this property that I'm talking about. I'm not saying that aluminum is not a factor here. I'm just saying I don't have any tests that say that. There are many, many people that say that I've said such a thing. I don't, thus far, and I'm completely open to it when I get to work. But my work does say over and over and over, group one and group two at a periodic table, the elements are repeatedly being identified, and they share a very common, important physical characteristic, and that is that they are easily ionized. Aluminum does not satisfy that, and that's a whole separate subject if it ever even comes into the picture.
Wow.
Okay?
All right.
So now you go on to the question of, well, what does it mean if you were to have something that could create more ions in the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm.
And the first approach that I took was just looking at the question of health. Not even the electromagnetic side, because I've actually done a lot of that work before. But now I had direct evidence that says, yes, this should probably be happening. And so I wondered what would happen to health. And so this raises the question of positive and negative ions and their effect on our health.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing you may have had some shows on or discussions on that topic, and I won't go into great depth on it.
Well, there are negative ion generators out there.
There certainly are. And I guess what I'll say here is that this is also a very important topic. There's been a great deal of research done on it, very serious work. I've seen work that's dating back to the 50s and such from many other countries, especially sports athletes and this type of thing. They were evaluating performance of individuals under varied ion concentrations.
Right.
And what I saw in the literature, I saw two things. One is that there's very definite physical effects that are expected. And I also saw a simplification that takes place in many cases. And that is, if you seek out the common discussions and research material on the net, in some places you're going to come up with this simplification that says, oh, positive ions are bad for you, negative ions are good. And my work is simply saying that it's simply not that simple. What is real and what should be the case is that nature has a balance of these ions. There is an anticipated balance of these ions, just as all life is. If we look at all life, you have balances between forces. And the same is to take place with ions. And what we are going to talk about are imbalances in these concentrations and how they're affecting us.
Okay. All right. We'll do that in just a couple minutes as we continue. This will be part one with Clifford. We're going to have him back to finish his list. What the bottom line is here is, it's not good. The atmosphere has been altered drastically. The impacts therein are not fully understood, but we're going to get a better idea about them in our next half hour. So stay right there, and we'll be back. Okay, I'm right back with you and Clifford Carnahan. Half an hour to go with Clifford, talking about the atmosphere. So let's go, Clifford. The ionization of these two common and what we would normally think of as beneficial elements, calcium and phosphorus, is a problem. There are two groups of them. And this particular group, apparently when they ionize, they... you described it years ago, and we just to keep it simple, what apparently is happening, at least partially, is the conversion of the lower portion of our atmosphere into a medium upon which many things can be played out. That's one part of it.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And it is a dominant theme that appears to characterize this project. No question in my mind about it. The metals that we're talking about, specifically calcium, potassium, magnesium, and barium right now.
I said phosphorus. My mistake. Potassium.
Okay, that's fine. These four specifically that are now being confirmed over and over.
Okay, name those again, please.
Calcium, potassium, magnesium, and barium.
Okay.
These metals produce positive ions. It's what they do. It's when they're subjected to photoionization, the energy from sunlight, they produce positive ions.
Okay.
Magnesium is the most difficult of the group. Barium, well, the other, you'll see, the list is there if anybody cares to look at it, but they produce positive ions. Now, even though I'm making the statement, which is very true, that this issue will not simplify to the point of positive ions are bad and negative ions are good. Nevertheless, that's a fair statement that we are dealing with something that would appear to be producing a higher level or an excessive level of positive ions. So we can keep that in mind.
Right.
So then the next stage is we ask, what are the health effects? And these citations are all referenced in my work here. I'm going to list four effects that showed up in the search that I made on the effects of increased positive ion counts on the human body.
Increased
first is the impairment of the body's ability to absorb oxygen, leading to headaches, asthma attacks, reduced circulation in the brain, and emotional irritability.
Okay.
Number two, the development of allergies. Ionized air is associated with the following conditions: allergic bronchitis, allergic sinusitis, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and chronic respiratory tract allergies. It may also be recalled that chronic lower respiratory disease now ranks as a third leading cause of death in this country, and that it continues to climb in this ranking. Let's place that top five. Forget the three right now. Place it in the top five. It's working its way up. Higher levels of serotonin in the bloodstream, triggered by excessive numbers of positive ions in the environment. And number four, a reduction in the body's ability to filter airborne contaminants from lung tissue. Now, when I established this list, what amazed me, this is a case where you do the research, you see where it leads, and then you make sense of it. But when I saw this list, the list is exactly the symptoms that are primarily being reported. It's very strong. You know, we've talked about...
About them all the time.
The asthma levels are through the roof.
Yep.
I have, you know, the allergy situation is just tremendous. We'll talk more about that as we go. But this list was basically a one-to-one match with the primary symptoms that have been reported in association with these operations over the years. Documented in the health records. So that, of course, makes one extremely curious, to say it mildly, that now you have physical symptoms that have an explanation that makes sense from the best information that is available to us. So there's a strong possibility of connections or correlations between those two things. One is the physical sampling and testing that's providing the data, and the second being the effect upon human health. I'm going to jump ahead, and this is with your permission. I know that we don't want to read too much, but I think the quickest way that I can get through something which needs to be stated is to read three paragraphs that ties back into the laboratory report that started this whole thing. Hmm. Everything that we talk about, whether it's this show and or including next one, was entirely precipitated by the one lab report.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to read what has happened subsequently with respect to that lab report, so that people have a sense that there is an issue here. There is a problem. And this lab test is an example of the types of problems we're running into. And this is with your permission, Jeff. This is about three paragraphs. I won't stop. I just read it through. Is that okay with you?
Go right ahead, sure.
Okay. The title of this page is called Laboratory Services Terminated. It is dated approximately 2 months after I received that initial lab report with the increased levels, high levels of calcium and potassium.
Over a
rural area. Okay, here we go. It has been reported that a water testing laboratory has recently terminated its services to a customer. This customer requested and paid for the testing of a rainwater sample in a rural location within the United States. The customer recently provided the results of that analysis to the public through this site being me.
Mm-hmm.
It is also stated by the same customer that, upon inquiry, no logical or professional reply has been given that explains or accounts for the termination of the environmental testing service to this individual. It is also a fact that the original attempt to relay the laboratory report by mail to me failed, and that this easily could have gone unknown and unnoticed. Alternative means of transmission of the report were required. Paragraph 2. At this point, it will be mentioned that a similar result occurred approximately 6 years ago with an atmospheric testing firm. In that case, services were terminated when the results of the lab report on atmospheric fiber analysis were challenged and refuted in a personal visit by this researcher being me again.
I remember that.
Yes. Upon making the first two of 9 contradictions known to the principal of that company, this owner stated that, quote, "this discussion is now over," unquote. Upon this development, I submitted a letter in person to the president of this firm. This letter stated that the action of this company might eventually be made known to the public. This statement now provides notification to the public of that event. Additional attempts to properly identify the material have failed and are noted below. Third paragraph. And what's different with that statement there is that I've never let it be known that I wrote a letter to that company.
Right.
Paragraph 3. It will now also be disclosed that the career of a state criminal forensic scientist was threatened when an interest was expressed by that individual to assist in the identification of a certain atmospheric fibrous sample. It was stated in that case that the career of that individual and all post-retirement benefits of the forensicist would be terminated if any involvement in identification were to take place. The act of laboratory identification was never completed. This event occurred approximately 4 years ago. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has refused to identify the same material. Extraordinary biological components within that material have been repeatedly been observed and recorded.
Wow.
So
same old, same old. Yeah.
I'm not in a position, let's say, of holding certain information, but I do make a judgment, a determination as to when something is appropriate to discuss. And what this statement does is let it be known that I have been involved with or I am familiar with circumstances in the past, dating back to 6 years ago now, where attempts were made by either individuals, sometimes in very good faith putting forth money to try to achieve a certain honesty in the testing process and to make that information available to the public. This statement lets it be known that I have been aware that certain attempts have been thwarted at a very serious level. And unless I felt it was appropriate to make this information known, I have not. The reason that I feel it is appropriate at this time is because now there is a potential pattern that we have to acknowledge. It is not necessarily an isolated case. And this last one was about as direct as could be. Here you had a citizen simply putting forth good money to have a test done in a professional manner. It shows what I would regard as some unusual results. I make that information available to the public. It actually spawns a whole generation now of additional research that needs to be done that ties in with years of previous research, mm-hmm. except confirming it at the laboratory level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then this individual is completely in no explainable fashion whatsoever, has that right, has that privilege of testing simply cut off with no explanation whatsoever. And that is extremely disturbing, because for those that try to make the claim, why don't you just have a lab report done? It has been attempted. It is very difficult for individuals to sponsor these types of projects. They're dealing with money out of their own pocket. They have no checks and balances and auditing of the system, and they are dependent upon the results that are given. And there is a pattern that there is an effort to contain the full disclosure of information on these subjects.
Absolutely. Wow. Wow, Clifford. All right. Hold on. We'll pause and come right back with Clifford Carnicum after this. Heard Clifford Carnicum lay out some pretty horrifying information, quite frankly. You can't, folks, take a sample of rainwater to a lab, private lab, and get it tested, get it analyzed in all cases. Maybe in no cases. We don't know. This is not good. And I guess this is a fairly good place. We have about 5 minutes left, Clifford, to kind of... Before we, I'm looking ahead, maybe a week from tonight we'll do part two. Maybe
okay, that would be fine, Jeff. Yeah, I'll look at my schedule and we'll see what night we can come up with.
I think what we should do here is try to sketch out some of the baseline implications of this wholesale reconfiguration of the lower atmosphere as we used to know it. What are we talking about? You mentioned the health issues. The common complaints of people, the common sicknesses today, match up perfectly with what we've been talking about in terms of the observations of this report and other research. And we would expect these kinds of health problems, which we're seeing. What else? What other implications?
Well, the areas now, I've had a list of five areas where I believe that the data supports operations of the type they're doing. It's been a list of five. That list is now seven to me. I've never really written up on the other two. I'll go through that list very briefly with you. And we've talked about these before, other than one has to realize the extent or scope and
right.
that all these interconnect. The five previous areas were that of environmental modification. And if people want to say weather control, fine, I say it. But environmental modification is more general than that. It means changing everything about our environment. Environmental modification, military operations, biological operations. And I'll tell you, I've kept the biological side real low-key. There's more that I could talk about than I have, but people have a real hard time with that one. And we're going to need a more open environment before we can take on that subject as fully as it needs to. The next is electromagnetic, which is a big part of what we're talking about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Geophysical, literally the possibility of affecting the Earth as a whole, the geophysical processes of the Earth. We're going to talk about that at the tail end of our next session. And I'll mention the other two right now. One of them is pretty darn strong, and the other is certainly more conjecture, but still fits within the data. Number six on my list would now be the topic of surveillance. And I know you have to quit soon, but there's this whole area. You and I, we know about radar, right? And radar is when you send out a radio wave and it bounces off something and comes back.
Right.
And what you'll find is that object needs to be a certain size for radar to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty big in a relative sense. That's why airplanes and that type of thing work. It has to do with the wavelength of what you're sending out.
Right.
Well, instead of using radio waves, there are processes that use light waves to detect things. And the size of the particles that you're dealing with is no longer the size of airplanes. It is the wavelengths that correspond to light. That's how radar works. It has to do with radio waves. What's called LIDAR has to do with light waves. And the size of the particles you're dealing with are exactly the size of particles that we are talking about tonight. And that is, micron and submicron size. And so it opens up this whole avenue for a surveillance system. And I did some research on this, and it's, I think they're called the American Federation of Scientists, but the folks behind the atomic bomb, they have written a statement as to what they see as the most, let's say, exciting proposition for the future in the defense industry. And it is a development of a LIDAR surveillance system. And usually if you're talking about something, it's been in place for 20 years.
You got it. So surveillance of what, Clifford?
Well, really the limit is open-ended. When you're talking about the ingestion of, you know, micron or submicron particles, and what can piggyback along on those particles, you're conceivably talking about a tracking system. It's like the nanotechnology world of tracking.
Nowhere to hide.
It's conceivable to me.
Nowhere to hide.
And the other is, and this is more conjecture, but I'll say it the technical way first, and then you can generalize it. The technical way would be the detection of plasma disturbances. That would be the technical description. Okay. Disturbances in a plasma state. Disturbances in an electrical gas.
Ah.
Now let's throw out the general term UFO.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is conceivable that you could, and the reason I bring this up is if you look at the video I took of that orb, it's fascinating, but you can visually see disturbances in the surrounding atmosphere and gas.
So you can actually
see it on camera. There are disturbances taking place that were caught on film. So one can consider, in line with surveillance, an additional detection system that would be working on an ionic and plasma level. These are now seven areas that I believe are fairly encompassed by the data that's available.
Wow. All right. So the potential here, obviously, is nothing can move through the atmosphere without being detected.
Nothing can move anywhere without being at the nano level.
That's right. Nowhere to hide. That's what I said. Right.
Yes, that's right. And so this is all conceivable, and I wouldn't be talking about it unless it made sense in terms of all the data.
How did these tie into Bernard Eastland's patents of 10, 12, 15 years ago?
Oh, man. If you take the time to actually read the Eastland patent, and I have. It started out being Greek, but I've been through that thing. And I'll tell you, it's like you can go through every line in that patent and you can ascribe meaning to that which now surrounds us from it. Literally, just about line by line, and many things that we'll be talking about on the next subject on cyclotronic resonance and this type of thing. That patent is literally like a blueprint in principle for what we are seeing now.
We are living we're discussing a subatomic world, basically.
Yeah.
Practically.
So I hope that helps, Jeff. We got through some of it. A fair part. We did pretty well. And number five on your list will be pretty short next time, and sort of six and on is a whole new other topic to begin working into.
All right. Thank you. I look forward to it very much. You'll hear information like this, friends, virtually nowhere else. Clifford Carnicom is remarkable. My friend, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Jeff, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for what you're doing.
Okay. All right. We'll pause on that note and come right back. Carnicom.com, CARNICOM.com.